Okay, we are continuing with our introduction to Pirkei Avos. We'll eventually finish the introduction, but not this week. Okay, we're in the middle of explaining various reasons why this Masechta is referred to as Avos. We said it's really for sure not Pirkei Avos, because that just refers to the various chapters that we read of the book of the Maseches of Avos during the time between Pesach and Yom Kippur. So it's Pirkei Avos then. But it's either called Maseches Avos, the Tractate of Avos, or its real name is Mishnas Chasidim. Okay. We gave various reasons last time. Now we're going to go on. Another reason why it's called Maseches Avos is because, the Tosfos Yontif says, these are mostly words of Musar, and Musar that deal with good behavior, Midos Tovos, Derech Eretz, and the importance of learning Torah, and we already explained why those two things go together. And the Chachamim are called Avos, because it says that a Rebbe is called a father, and students are called children. Because a Rebbe, just like a parent, brings his children into this world and gives them this world, a Rebbe brings his children, his students, to the world to come. So in that respect, he's like a father. So this is Maseches Avos. These are the words of the Avos, the teachers who bring us to the world to come by learning their Musar, their Derech Eretz, and so on. Why it doesn't apply to every Masechta in Shas, I'm not 100% sure. But since this specifically, there's another opinion that says that this Maseches teaches one a derech, a path in learning Torah, and also, obviously, in Musar, in Derech Eretz. And the one who teaches a path, how to do it, not just teaches laws, doesn't just teach individual details, but gives you a path in this world, that path is the path that brings you to the world to come. Therefore, more specifically, the term avos, teachers that are like parents that bring you to the world to come, applies specifically to this Masechta. Another reason is that this Masechta, what we have over here, are avos. It doesn't refer to the people who said them, but rather to what is contained in this Masechta. What's contained in this Masechta is the main categories, the avos. And however, there are subcategories and subcategories, and you can learn many, many details that are spin-offs of the main things that are mentioned here. So therefore, don't think that this Masechta has in it an exhaustive study of all Derech Eretz and everything there is to say about Torah study. It is the major points, and then you have to go into it and delve into it and understand the secondary points that and details that are hinted to and implied by these avos, by these major categories. So this is a Masechta that doesn't deal with a lot of details. You have to go into the details yourself. But these are the major categories. Now, along those lines, I think there's a reason why. Many other Masechtas also have major subjects, and there are a lot of details or whatever. But here specifically, the Tanoim could not elucidate all of the details. because when it comes to Derech Eretz, and even when it comes to a Derech in learning Torah, the details depend on a lot of circumstances. Derech Eretz depends for different people, different things. What's good for one person is not necessarily the way that another person should function. And same thing goes with the manner of how one learns Torah. What is good for one person may not be good for another person. Everybody has to get their own personal derech in learning Torah based on their intellect, based on their makeup, emotional makeup, because ein adam lo meid ela b'makom shelibo chafetz. The main thing with Torah learning is a person should learn what interests him. Everybody has to learn the basics. But what you delve into, what you spend most of your time on, should be what you have a connection to, what you're interested in. Mashalibo chafetz. And therefore, the Tana could not give more than the general ideas, and how to apply them specifically depends on each person, especially by Derech Eretz, and especially by a Derech in Torah. So this Masechta is called Avos, because it couldn't give more than the Avos, more than the general major topics, and leave up to a person to get the implications and the details on his own, because the details are very personal. I think that's also an idea. That the Medrash Shmuel says. Another idea why it's called Avos is because if one learns Torah, which is again one of the major points of this Masechta, and he has Derech Eretz, so that will lead the world to have an existence, like we explained a few weeks ago. And therefore, these words, the subject matter of this Masechta, creates toldos, creates the existence, generations. Right? It generates existence to the world. So what generates toldos? Avos. So therefore it's called Avos because it generates kiyum and existence to the world through Torah learning, bein adam lamakom, that gives the spiritual energy to the world, and through Derech Eretz, which gives the ability for the world to exist, because if people can't relate to each other and interact properly, then there is anarchy in the world and the world can't exist, bein adam lechaveiro. So by delineating Torah study, it gives spiritual existence to the world. Without Torah study, the world can't exist. And it gives physical existence to the world by teaching people how to act properly and interact with each other. Okay. Another reason, the Bina Le'itim says, why this is called Avos, because a father has to teach his child Torah, and he also has to teach him Derech Eretz. I would say that we'll split it up. The father teaches his child Torah, but I think the main one who teaches Derech Eretz is the mother, and that is not my understanding. That is the Shaloh HaKadosh says. He says that the mother is the one who is around most of the time, whereas the father, either he's learning Torah, so he's in a base medrash, or he's working for a living. If he's doing none of those things, he's not a scoundrel, and therefore doesn't teach his kids anything. So either he's sitting in a base medrash, or he's working hard for a living. So he's usually not home. So who is the one who is able to teach a child Derech Eretz, and to teach a child how to exist in this world? That's basically the mother. Basically the mother. So the father has to teach his child Torah, and the mother teaches Derech Eretz, and those are the two main subjects of Avos, and therefore it's called Avos, because this is what the Avos, the parents, have to teach their children. And that is most certainly the way the world is. Right? It says that Michal, who was the one when Shaul sent soldiers to kill David. So I think it was Michal. Michal put the trophim in the bed to make it look like David HaMelech was sick, and then they discovered that it was just a statue or whatever, and he had escaped out the window. So one of the Mepharshim says that David was so busy as a king, so he was never home. So his wife made a statue of him so she'd remember what he looked like. I told my wife she should do that also, but she said she doesn't want to remember what I look like. So, in any case, but it is true that fathers usually don't have the time to teach their children the basics and to take care of the... I remember my wife years ago was tying the shoe of one of my sons, who is now a father of his own children, and he was about 5 or 6 at the time, and she was dressing him, helping him get dressed. And he said, "Mommy, how come mommies do so much things for their children and tatties don't?" So my wife, being a good wife, said, "That's not true." She said, "Tatties do things for their children too." And my son thought, and after a few minutes he said, "Yeah, Tati once tied my shoes." So I'm just saying this because this corroborates that, right? Avos, Torah teaching, even that I'm not so sure. My daughter, when she was about 12, the daughter that I share in common with Mrs. Brinus, I was on my way out to a shir in Netanya, and I was running late, and I really had to leave on the spot there, otherwise I'd be late for the shir. And as I was running out, she came over to me and said, "Tati, I need help with my homework." I said, "Poey, I just can't. I'm going to be late to a shir in Netanya. I have to give a shir there. I just can't. I have to leave." She said, "Okay." She said, "After 120 years, you know what they're going to say? Oh, he was such a good speaker, but look at his kids." I stayed home, helped her with her homework, and explained to Netanya why I came late. In any case, so this just makes me feel good because it justifies, you see, mothers are the ones that are supposed to take care of their children's derech eretz because they're the ones that are around. And fathers can teach their kids Torah. You can pick the time when you do it, and that's that. Okay, enough of these personal confessions. I'll save it for between me and the Rabbanu Shimon Yom Kippur. Okay. The Vilna Gaon says another idea, which is almost the opposite of what the Chasam Sofer says. We'll try to resolve the contradiction. The Vilna Gaon says like this: we know that there's a concept of avos and toldos when it comes to Shabbos. There are 39 avos malacha, and then there are the toldos, the subcategories. What makes something a main category, and what makes it a subcategory? So the Gemara says that which is openly mentioned in the Torah by Shabbos, that which was openly done in the Mishkan, one of the 39 malachas that were done openly in the Mishkan, those are called avos. The things that weren't done in the Mishkan necessarily, but were similar to things done in the Mishkan, those were called toldos. So whatever is mentioned openly in the Torah is called an av. Things that aren't mentioned openly in the Torah are called toldos. Therefore, the Vilna Gaon says like this: even though many of the things that are mentioned in this Masechta, you won't find open sentences in the Torah that say these things, as opposed to if you're something in Masechta Sukkah, you'll find about Sukkah in the Torah. But here, Derech Eretz is something that there are very few places in the Torah that you can find things that say specifically what it says in Pirkei Avos. It says the Vilna Gaon, If you learn properly, everything that is mentioned in Pirkei Avos has a source in the Torah. You just have to know where to find it. The Vilna Gaon knew where to find it. Right? And we will try, as we learn Pirkei Avos, to show you where the sources are. Right? And even as Mordechai brought out, that maybe we will connect it to the Parsha also as we learn these things and show where these things are mentioned. But as the Chassam, so, and therefore it's called Avos. Don't make the mistake to think that these are only toldos. These are only things that have no source, open source in the Torah, but they're Avos. They do have an open source in the Torah if you know where to find them. The Chassam Sofer says that these are things that that don't have any open source. Most of the things that are in the Gemara, we learn out from sentences in the Torah with the 13 attributes of how to learn things from the Torah, the Yud Gimel Mido Shatorah and the Dreshet Bohem, and they are toldos, they are emanations, right, from Torah things. These things are not necessarily emanations from things open in the Torah, but they're a mesorah that the rabbis had that was handed down orally and doesn't have its source necessarily in the written Torah, but it's things that are not toldos, they are not emanations from the written Torah, but they are avos. They are things that were handed down by mesorah themselves. Now that seems to contradict what the Vilna Gaon says. The Vilna Gaon seems to say every single thing here has a source in the Torah. And the Chassam Sofer says, things here do not have a source necessarily in the written Torah. They are part of the oral Torah. These are things that were handed down orally, and their place is not in the written Torah. Their place is completely, it's like what's called the Halacha L'Moshe Mi-Sinai. Halacha L'Moshe Mi-Sinai is something that has no source in the written Torah. It is purely oral Torah. Okay? Now, I'll give an example for that is the halachas of Arava. The fact that on Asukis, aside from Esrog and Lulav and Hadashim and Aravos that you take together, there was a mitzvah of taking just Aravos in the Beis HaMikdash. It applied basically in the Beis HaMikdash and making Hakafos with them and putting them on the Mizbeah. We have a remembrance of that on Hoshana Rabbah, where we take the Aravos and we beat them, right, and we shake them. That is a remembrance of the mitzvah of Arava in the Beis HaMikdash. You won't find that mitzvah in the Torah. That is a halacha of the Moshe Mi-Sinai. Another halacha of the Moshe Mi-Sinai is what constitutes a mechitza. Not a mechitza between men and women, but a mechitza for Shabbos. What is a public domain? What's a private domain? How high does a mechitza have to be considered a partition? That's all halacha l'moshe mi-sinai. How much do you have to eat to fulfill a mitzvah or to transgress an aveira? That's shiuri, kezias, revias of wine. All halacha l'moshe mi-sinai. You won't find this in the Torah. These are all oral laws that were handed down together with the Torah. And therefore, they're called avos. They are not emanations from the written Torah that we learn out from the written Torah, but they are things, avos themselves. They are major things themselves that were handed down parallel to the written Torah as an oral tradition, totally oral tradition. So that is what the Chassam Sofer says. The Vilna Gaon says everything has a source in the Torah. Now, there's no real contradiction, because the Rambam classifies halacha l'moshe mi-sinai as something that has no source in the written Torah. It is completely an oral tradition. However, the Rambam also says that after the fact, the rabbis found hints in the Torah that they used as a memory aid. So you'll remember what these oral traditions are. They found places in the Torah that they used as hints to these oral things. according to the Rambam, we don't learn those oral things from these places in the Torah. It's not their source. But once we know them, we use the written Torah as a hint to remember these things. So they're not the source of these things, but they are memory tools. There's places in the written Torah that once you know these oral traditions, you can use those places in the written Torah to be a reminder. Again, it's not the source. If it wouldn't be for the oral tradition, we would not learn that from the written Torah. But once we have it, we can find a hint to it in the written Torah. Okay, it's after the fact. That, if that's the case, then we can say both are true. The way that Sam Sofer says, these are not things whose source is in the Torah, and they are toldos. They are emanations from that, but they are avos to themselves. However, the Vilna Gaon says, once we have that, there is a hint to every single thing that is said in Pirkei Avos somewhere in the written Torah. It's not the source of it, but it is hinted to in the written Torah, and therefore the things that are mentioned here are avos, because they do have at least a hint to them in the written Torah. You can find somewhere in the written Torah that you can use as a memory tool for these things. Okay, that's called an asmachta. An asmachta is where something is either rabbinic or it's totally from the oral Torah, and the rabbis quote a sentence that seems to say that sentence is talking about this rabbinic thing, but it's only rabbinic. Or the sentence is talking about something that is purely oral Torah, and the Gemara says asmachta bi'alma. It is not the source. It's only a memory tool, which the Rambam learns. Okay. So therefore, both of these things can be true. The Mevar Tanura and others say that we would think that this Masechta, a lot of it, is talking about Musar, nice behavior, Midos Tovos, and Goyim also have Sfarim, books about proper behavior, Derech Eretz. So I would think that these things are like by the Goyim. The rabbis on their own came to what is proper behavior and what's good to do and what is proper to do and whatever, what's acceptable behavior. Right? It's on their own. Right. Says the Rav, that's why this Masechta starts with a detailed tracing of the Masorah. God gave the Torah to Moshe on Har Sinai, and Moshe gave it to Yoshua, and so on. To let me know that the words that are contained in this Masechta are not the fruit of the rabbi's imagination. But this is part, the same way that the Torah tells us about Shabbos and Sukkah and Yom Kippur and all the other laws, these are also part of Torah laws. Derech Eretz is not merely something that the rabbis dreamed up because it's the right thing to do. But the Derech Eretz, the Torah has its Derech Eretz, and it is part of the Torah. It's part of the Masorah. Whether it's in the written Torah or the oral Torah is irrelevant. But it is part of the tradition of Yiddishkeit going back to God and Har Sinai. They are godly laws. They are not merely laws of society relative to how people have to act to each other. But they're absolute laws that the rabbis received, not that they made up. And even though one could think differently, because even the Goyim have laws similar to this, so what is the difference between Mishpatei B'nei Adam and Mishpatei Hashem? The difference is that the laws of human beings, first of all, are not absolute. They are very relative to time and place, and they are dependent on situations. And therefore, sometimes they change. What's good in one generation may not be good in a different generation. What's good in one situation may not be good in a different situation. They are not absolute truth. They are merely laws made that people should be able to get along with each other. And therefore, they can change drastically based on how people change. That's one thing. And that's in a positive way, in a good way. They're not absolute laws. They are just relative laws to what is good for any one society. And at different times, different things are good. And therefore, these laws can change. And for in a good way, nothing wrong with that. On the other hand, Mishpatei Hashem Emes Tzod Kuyafta. And therefore, what's also, since they can change and they're not absolute, there can be contradictions between them. This law contradicts a different law. But this law was meant in this situation, this one was meant in a different situation, so it's no problem that they contradict each other. Or this one was meant at this time, and they do contradict, but they're meant for two different times. The laws of God are emes. They're not relative. They're not just dependent on what works. They are essentially, intrinsically true. And therefore, Tzod Kuyachtov, they all work in harmony. And they don't depend on time or place. They always are true, except sometimes this law applies, sometimes this law applies. But the Torah itself tells you where it applies, where it doesn't. It's not just up to the whims of people to decide what will work in this place at this time. The laws of the Torah are absolute truth. They are intrinsically true, and therefore there are no contradictions between them, because all of them are true. And you just have to understand where they apply and where they don't apply, but they're not something that one can take with his own whims and decide whether this applies or doesn't apply, or it contradicts another law or whatever. A second difference is, that's on the positive side, where the laws of human beings are positive laws. The Goyim were given the mitzvah, according to some, to set up a social justice system. That's dinim. That's the seventh of the seven laws of Noah. The laws of Noah are not to steal, not to murder, not to eat meat from a living animal, take or cut meat from a living animal and eat it even after the animal dies, that the meat was cut off the animal was alive, not to be immoral. Certain kinds of immorality are prohibited. That's four. Not to serve idolatry. That's five. And the sixth one is, what did we skip? Not to blaspheme, not to curse God. The seventh one, according to some, is to set up a social justice system that there should be law and order in the world. And they make up the laws themselves, according to most opinions. According to another opinion, the seventh law is that they have to try and punish people who transgress the other six laws. And that's one of the reasons why the people of Shechem were liable to a death penalty, which Shimon and Levi carried out, because they transgressed one of their seven mitzvahs. They did not judge Shechem and Hamor for what they did, which was against the laws of Noah. And since they didn't judge them, they transgressed one of the laws of Noah, and any goy who transgresses any of the laws of Noah is liable to a death penalty. Since they only have seven, they're all liable to death penalties. Unlike us, we have 613, there are certain ones that are death penalties, there are other ones that are not death penalties. But by them, all their seven, if you don't do them, you get death. So, and Shimon and Levi decided to be the ones to take care of it. Yaakov said, it's not your business. You're not the judges to give them the death penalty. So you did a terrible thing to us. In any case, whatever, that's what last week said. Yes?
They don't need a warning?
They don't need a warning, no. They don't need a warning. They don't need two witnesses, even one witness, whatever. Okay. In any case, so according to others, though, the non-Jewish world has to set up a court system, laws that people should be able to get to deal with each other and to live in a functioning society. And those laws are man-made. And they can be very, very nice, very good laws. That's why it says, but they're not the same thing as the Torah laws. We live by a code of law, even between man and man, which is divine, which is a different level, completely different level. Because our divine laws are not merely things to create a functioning society. They're not just situational ethics, man-made ethics. The laws are intrinsically true, divine, and have tremendous implications not only between man and man, but between man and God. I'll give you an example in a second. And therefore, we say in davening, David HaMelech said in Tehillim, Lo asa chen l'chol goy. God didn't do what he did for us, to all the other nations. U'mishpatim bal yidaum halalukah. God did not make known his mishpatim to the nations of the world. Now, mishpatim, as opposed to chukim, chukim are laws that are beyond rationale. Kashas, right? Milk and meat. That's not a rational law. Okay, there are many laws in the Torah that are beyond rationale. Not eating chametz on Pesach. Most of the laws that are between man and God are beyond rationale. But the laws between man and man are rational laws. Don't murder, don't steal. They're rational laws. But it says, God didn't make known the mishpatim, which seemingly are rational laws to the goyim. Goyim know mishpatim. They may not know chukim. He didn't make known his chukim. He didn't tell them about basar b'cholov. He didn't tell them about chametz on Pesach. But he told them they know the rational laws of mishpatim. The answer is no. Their mishpatim are mishpatim that they create. That is totally rational. But our mishpatim are God-given laws that are not necessarily completely rational. Example, I heard this from Rabbi Soloveitchik Zatzal from Boston, or Yosheber Soloveitchik. Said that the black and white areas of civil law are rational. Don't murder. Makes sense. It's a rational thing. If everybody goes around murdering everybody else, there's anarchy, and there can't be a society. On the other hand, the gray areas of those laws, you need a Torah to tell you, otherwise on your own, rationally, you would come to different conclusions. For instance, euthanasia, which is not young people in Asia, but it is mercy killing. I wouldn't want to debate somebody purely from a rational point of view whether mercy killing is okay or not, because rationally it sounds okay. You have somebody who's 119 years old, can't see, can't hear, can't eat, right, basically is suffering terribly. He says, look, put me out of my misery. Right? Just give me, you know, some narcotics or whatever, an overdose, and let me leave this world. Begging you. So, it's either rationally speaking, sounds okay to me, right? What value is there to this life? The guy's begging you. So, why not? So, rationally, seems to be okay. But it's also, and it's murder if you do that, under most circumstances. Why? Because God gave us a law that says don't murder, meaning you are not the balabos over your life, I am. And unless I tell you you can take that life, you're not allowed to. So you can want whatever you want, but al korcho chatochai and al korcho chatoneis, it's against your will. You are not the balabos of life or death. And if you understand that, that's something divine. That's not rational. That's beyond rationale. So the gray area of mercy killing is not rational, but it's part of the Torah of murder. Same thing goes with abortion. I wouldn't want to debate a pro-abortionist merely from rational grounds. Because, you know, well, it's my body, right? And it's not a viable human being. And therefore, what's it called? Woman has a right to say that I'm not interested in bringing this baby into the world because at this point it's my body and it's not viable without me. And whatever the arguments are they rational arguments? Could be. What's wrong with them? The Torah says that it is a human being and you're not allowed to abort it and you're not the balabos over that child. It's not your child per se. It's your child for many responsibilities you have. But it's not yours to do whatever you want. When the child is growing up, you can't take him and throw him off the terrace like some women do. right? Unfortunately. It's not your child you can do what you want with. It's not your handkerchief that you can decide to throw in the garbage. You have responsibilities. You brought that child into the world. It's not yours. You don't own it. The Rabbanim is a partner in that, and without him, there's no life. So he has the right to tell you what you do with that child. So is that rational? No. Beyond rational. It puts God into the equation. But the Goyim, they deal from a totally rational standpoint. Right? And therefore, rational may be rational. So, Mishpatim by Yadon. God didn't make known to the nations of the world the Mishpatim. Not just the Dinim. Not just the Chukim. Every Mishpat has areas of it that are gray areas that are not necessarily rational, even though the major black and white areas are rational. In addition to that, another reason why these laws, even though they seem to be rational laws, they seem to be laws of Derech Eretz. And why do they need a Mesorah? Because if you base your laws on human logic, human beings have the ability to distort anything according to what they want. And what is good one day, if you don't like it, can be bad the next day. What is wrong today can be right tomorrow if your desires change. And only if you are bound to an ethical code that God says, then you're not the Bala boss to decide what's right and what's wrong. God decides. And your whims usually can't change them. I mean, people can be akshonim too and change God's word too, but it's much more difficult. The example to that is the Nazis, right, made it right. They didn't say murder's okay. Murder was wrong. They had a court system. They had a justice system. The laws were corrupt. The laws were distorted. Nuremberg laws. They made laws. According to those laws, it's okay to kill Jewish children. It's a mitzvah. Jews are not part of what it's not allowed to murder. That's not called murder. That's called ethnic cleansing. It's okay. Just change the terms, and it becomes okay. All of a sudden, murder's okay, except this is not called murder. And that's exactly what Chazal say about Sodom. Famous Medrash that I remember reading in the Jewish press when I was a kid. Every year they had the same story at Parshas Lech Lecha. That Sodom. So Eliezer, the Eved of Avram, one day traveled to Sodom and he was mugged. They beat him up because they didn't like guests, they didn't like strangers. So they made sure that people who came to Sodom didn't want to ever come back. They didn't make it too comfortable, so they beat him up and left him wounded. But Eliezer was a strong person, so he got up and he pursued his attackers and he caught them. And he dragged them into court. Now, in the courts of Sodom, it says the judges' names were Sheker, Kozov, Lie, Deceit. Those were the names of the judges. Right. Very similar. I really like my freedom. I don't want to be put in jail. In any case, by any of the judges who are called Sheker and Kozov or whatever. So Eliezer drags his assailants into court. The judge says to him, "What do you want?" He said, "These people mugged me. They attacked me. I want justice." The judge says, "Okay. So tell me, did they cause you to bleed?" He said, "Yes." He said, "Fine. In our country, bloodletting, right, is a very positive thing, and people pay for it. So you owe them $50 for bloodletting. That's the justice in Sodom." So Eliezer was not stupid. So he punches the judge in the mouth, makes him bleed, and says, "Look, whatever you owe me, pay them." What a cute story. What does it mean? What it means is Sodom was not a lawless place. It wasn't do whatever you want. There were laws. There were judges. There were courts. But people have the ability to distort and make lawlessness law. And make right wrong and wrong right. And it's absurd, but that's the way it is. That's the mishpatim of human beings. Human beings' mishpatim can change and totally turn around at what was moral yesterday is immoral today, and what's immoral yesterday is moral today. In the 60s in America, they had a sexual revolution on the college campuses. And they created a new morality. That's what they called it, the new morality. Now, it's very interesting that if you study the new morality, it was very, very similar to the old immorality. They just changed the word. If you put new and call it new morality, then you can take immorality and make it moral. Just, this is a new morality. So people have the ability to take the moral and make it immoral and vice versa, to make what is lawful, unlawful, and so on. And again, just look at Nazi Germany. You don't have to go that far. Just look at the world. So therefore, a Torah code, which is absolute, which depends on Mesorah and not on people's whims, is a very different code. Therefore, it's important to know that even though these laws seem to be rational laws, they are not the product of the rabbi's whims. Because if they are, then they're no different than the laws of the Goyim, and they have all the same limitations. These are absolute laws that were handed down orally, are hinted to in places in the Torah. They are no less halachos than anything else in the Torah. They're part of the Mesorah of Moshe Kibbutz Torah Misinai. That's why it's important to have that here, and that's why they're avos. Avos means that these are things that are foundations of Yiddishkeit, no less than Shabbos and Kashrus and all the other super rational laws. These are the same, even though they appear to be differently. And that's why it was important to have Moshe Kibbutz Torah Misinai as a preface to this Masechta. The other Masechtas I know, without Moshe Kibbutz Torah Misinai, there's no Sukkah, there's no Shofar, and there's no Kashrus. But Derech Eretz, ethics, that could exist even without that. Kamashmullah, no, it can't. That can be for Goyim, but not for Jews. For Jews, these are absolute laws that depend on the Torah, and therefore this Masechta is called, another reason why it's called Avos. We're almost finished. We are up to the reason number 8 we did. We have only 18, so we're getting there. Next week we will continue with this Hakdama. Then we'll go and speak about why the custom is to learn this Masechta when we do in the summer. And then we will get to the beginning of Pirkei Avos eventually.